All right, I want to welcome everyone. Good evening to everyone. Welcome. Welcome to part two of this series. For folks who were here last week, thank you for coming back. And we're going to continue. We spent last week talking quite a lot about the biblical Ger, this figure who lives sort of in Israelite society and is a part of it, but is not an Israelite, is not actually of the, certainly the ethnic fabric of the community, but more importantly, seems to actually live in some liminal space betwixt and between. For those of you who were not here last week, welcome. It's great to have you here. And you're going to join right into the conversation. But you are going to sort of periodically be led back or potentially afterwards want to kind of look up to get a little more in depth or even better listen to the recording of the first week to get some of this background on the biblical character. Because tonight we're going to spend our time doing a whirlwind tour of the rabbinic dissection, reinvention, and takedown of that biblical character, okay? Last week, really, we learned about the Ger without any added descriptors. The Ger is just the Ger who lives with you, a non-Israelite in the society who has to respect certain rules, has certain responsibilities, even mitzvot that they're expected to follow. There are certain opportunities for them to participate in public life. But there are also significant protections and significant obligations that the society has to that person. And we laid out last week how that on its own is a very interesting model to think about the presence of non-citizens either in Jewish controlled spaces like the contemporary state of Israel or Jewish influenced places or places where Jews feel responsibility for the broader society like in the United States, where there is a non-citizen population and a discussion of how to engage and teach with them and deal with it. Tonight, I'm not sure how it's going to strike you because some of the turns that we will see tonight are actually quite radical departures from or interpretations of the biblical literature we looked at last week. I'm going to let it sort of wash over us at the beginning and reserve some of my comments about what I think is going on here until the end. I want us to spend kind of time tracking what happens here very carefully so we can get to an intelligent discussion of the why it happens. Why is it that the rabbinic perspectives on the text about the ger, the stranger, this middle figure, take the turn we'll see them take? Let's try to be disciplined in kind of just understanding it before judging it and assessing it so we can then figure out why did what we saw here happen. Okay. With that, I want to give you just sort of a brief word of background to the rabbinic sources. And I want to emphasize, just as last week was kind of like a whirlwind tour of Tanakh, tonight is going to be a whirlwind tour of rabbinic midrash on this topic. We're somehow going to get through these 9 pages of material in the next hour and a half. Some of it will float a little above the surface, and some of it we're going to do very close reading on. What world do Chazal, do our sages in classical rabbinic sources, inherit? One of the questions that you always have to ask is, when the rabbis are reading the Torah in a certain way, are they the first ones ever to read it that way? Are there other people reading it in other ways? In our topic, it's a little hard to say. We noted that the Ger in the Bible gives us some conflicting messages. In one place, it seems like the Ger has to observe all kinds of laws, like not eating chametz on Pesach, fasting on Yom Kippur, being expected to follow the laws of purity around corpses and carcasses, etc., and being held accountable to not following those laws. But then on the other hand, in Dvarim, the ger is told, we are told it's perfectly fine to give the ger a carcass to eat, which seems to place the ger outside of the realm of full observance of the mitzvot incumbent on Israelites. There are some indications that there might have been some sensitivity to this dilemma prior to the rabbinic period. I quoted you 2 words in Greek transliteration here at the on the first page, the Second Temple background. where there are two terms, actually more than two, but two primary terms that are used in the Septuagint's translation of Ger, the Greek translation of the Bible, 2nd, 3rd century BCE, a pretty early text to start getting these translations. Sometimes the Ger is translated as proselutos. Sometimes the Ger is translated as paroikos. Now, proselutos may remind you of the not really English, but often said by Jews studying Torah word, proselyte, right? Sometime I'll tell you a story about a friend of mine and phylacteries on the New York subway for other words that Jews use as if they're like English words when they're not. But a proselyte, of course, is used for the most part to mean a convert, okay? And proselutos means someone who's sort of coming towards your way, coming towards you. Paroikos, from oikos, which means house, is a rendering that has less of a connotation of someone coming to your way, but someone who like lives in your house, is somehow resident with you. Now it happens that in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy, in the verse where it says you can give a nevela, a carcass, to a ger, the Greek translation of the Torah there reads paroikos, someone who kind of lives in your house. And for instance, in the passage in Shmot in Exodus that talks about the ger participating in the Korban Pesach, in the Pesach sacrifice, there it is rendered as proselutos. Now some have read that and said, ah, you see, the Greek translation of the Bible is already distinguishing between different kinds of gerim, the ways in which we almost felt the biblical material itself pulling apart at the seams last time. There, in fact, maybe is a hint there that people were aware that it was difficult to read ger with complete consistency across the biblical camp. Recent studies have cast major doubt on that, specifically because the Septuagint is not really the work of a single translator at a single moment in time, but actually the various books in the Greek translation of the Bible seem to be authored by different people or different groups at slightly different points in time, such that the latest scholarly material to come out on this basically says that's completely meaningless. The person writing the translation of Dvarim just happened to use paroikos more, and the person writing Exodus Shmot happened to use proselutos more, and even internally, there's indication that they may have used them just as synonyms, the way we use synonyms all the time in order to shake things up and not use the same word over and over. If we can say bright, brilliant, radiant, etc., it's not that we think those refer to completely different shades of light. Okay, so that I leave where it is. There is some sort of semantic range around rendering ger. I'm not sure we can conclude anything, and I certainly don't think we can pin what we see the rabbis doing in the text we're now going to turn to on some earlier phenomenon that clearly took a side on what to do with the biblical ger. Okay, with that, I want to start with some of the most striking, we'll see even narrative midrashic passages that effectively do a complete hatchet job on the ger as non-Israelite, who is ethnically other, but living in your midst, and transform that term entirely into meaning a convert, someone who has become a Jew, rather than being other and living among the Jews. Now, let me give you a few examples of this. I spared you, having already gotten up to 9 pages in 11-point font, I didn't render every verse here in translation. For those who were here last week, these are basically verses you already saw, but I'm going to take you through them, so don't worry. One of the most powerful statements of the equality of the ger in the Torah, despite the ger not being an Israelite, comes in Vayikra 19. That's the first two lines here. V'chi yagur itcha ger ba'aretzachem lo tonu oto. When a ger lives with you in your land, do not oppress him. Ke'ezrach mikem yihyeh lachem ager hagar itchem. Like the native born, so should be this stranger, sojourner, other, who lives with you. Ve'ahavta lo kamocha, love that person as you love yourself. Ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. Because you were gerim, were strangers in the land of Egypt. Not only is this a powerful statement, but the end of the verse, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, seems to be the black on white proof that ger does not mean a convert to something, but someone resident as a minority in the local native indigenous group, because we were not converts to Egyptian religion in Egypt. We were strangers and resident aliens there. Nonetheless, the Sifra, the Midrash on Vayikra, from around the time of the Mishnah, you know, spans a couple hundred years, the Midrashim here, but we're talking about things around, let's say, the first, second century, just completely reads this passage as if it never had anything to do with a non-Israelite who remains other. What does it say? If a person comes and says, I am a convert, and I render ger here in that sense, you'll see why. Is it possible that we accept him? That is to say, you just take someone's word, someone can just show up and say, yeah, I converted to Judaism. Scripture teaches, with you, one who is established to you. Meaning, back in the verse that we started with, Lamed Dalet, the second verse on the top, Ke'ezrach Mikem, like the native born among you, will be Hager Hagar Itchem. Okay? The convert who lives with you, sorry, we're back at the first verse. V'chi agur itcha ger ba'artzachem. When a ger lives with you in your land, this midrash says the with you here indicates that you know something about them. You are well informed about their history. The kind of ger, the kind of person who merits the title ger, is someone about whom you know how they converted in some way. They can't just show up and present themselves. How do we know that if they bring witnesses, that that is sufficient? Well, it says, v'chi yagur be'artzachem. Actually, if the person ends up living there and they're in your land, there has to be a way to be a ger. So we might not accept the person's word on their own, but once they prove it in some satisfactory way, that must be valid because the Torah talks about it as a case. That's only in the land. How do I know that you can have converts outside of the land of Israel? Because it says, itchem, with you, wherever you live. So why did it say baritzachem, in the land where you live? Because in the land of Israel, you need to bring proof that you're a convert. Outside the land of Israel, you don't need to bring proof that you're a convert. Now, so much for uniform standards of Jewishness the world over. That is another topic, okay? But what you see here is, the entire passage is about converts, right? This has nothing to do. This is simply not read in any way as being about a resident alien. And it goes on here to talk about the convert again and again. And if you look at the last line, okay, which is reflecting on what does it mean to say the ger will be like the ezrach, the native born? Last week we said it means the ger is not a part of the people. Nonetheless, you have to treat them with a certain fairness and equality. Here we learn something else. Like a native born, ka ezrach, ma ezrach shekibel alav et kol divrei haTorah, av ger shekibel alav kol divrei haTorah. How is the ezrach, the native born, like the ger, the stranger? Just as the Ezrach accepted upon themselves all the words of the Torah, all right, and here the sense is basically through their ancestors accepting it at Mount Sinai, and it flows through them to later generations, so too, the Ger is someone who accepts the authority of all of the mitzvot. Right? As we saw last week, whatever the Ger, the biblical Ger is, and however many mitzvot are being observed, it doesn't seem like all the mitzvot are being observed in a way that you need to, you need to prove that in order to get the biblical privileges and status. Here, the assumption is, when we're talking about the ger in this verse, who is being compared to the ezrach, that's the ger who has accepted the mitzvot. Right? In a very kind of heavy-handed way, I don't even want to say implication, I want to say assumption of this midrash is that there isn't really a category of a person who doesn't accept the framework of Judaism, who gets to be treated as an equal to the native born, really, in any way. Right? Other passages affirm this. The Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael on the bottom of the page, which is like the Sifra, an early Midrash, but this time on Shmot as opposed to Vayikra, has a sort of amazing scene here. I'll let you read it on your own. I referred to last time several times the Ger Amaleki in the cycle of stories about David. There's this figure who shows up, who is reported to have, you know, dealt out a mercy blow to Saul as he was about to get captured by the Philistines, and he describes himself as a Ger Amaleki. And that seems to be pretty clear proof. Like, he's an Amaleki. He's an Amalekite. He is not an Israelite, but he has the title Ger. This Midrash in the Mechilta reimagines the story as the man is coming to David asking to convert. Okay, the scene is not that he comes to report on what happened in the battle in Gilboa, but now this Ger Amaleki is literally a prospective Amalekite convert. And the reason David strikes him down, which he does in the Bible because he says, how could you have touched Mashiach Hashem? How could you have killed Saul even if he asked you to do this? Is here because he remembered the teaching that even though you're supposed to accept converts from all the nations of the earth, you're not allowed to accept them from the Amalekites. Them you have to wipe out, and so the Ger Amaleki reaches his due. But this is an incredible inversion of a story about an other who is nonetheless resident, who now the only possibilities are you're out or you're converting in. All right, that story gets completely rewritten. And the final passage here in the Mechilta, which also I'll invite you to look at on your own, goes into a long kind of, I don't know how to put it. It's almost a sort of like epic comparison of Jews and Gerim. And it's very clear that the things that are being said about the Gerim are only things that it makes sense to say about converts, about people who have joined in with the Jewish people because they have signed up for their mission. The chapter that's quoted over and over again in that Midrash is Isaiah 56, which we saw briefly at the end last time, where Yeshayahu talks about the B'nei HaNechar, HaNilvim Al Hashem L'Sharato, the people from outside who join in to serve God. These are not people who are a resident minority in the land of Israel under Jewish political control. These are Gentiles who hear about the God of Israel and the Jewish religion and want to be a part of it. Those people now become the Gerim that we're talking about. Now, for those who were here last week, you'll recall we said that by the time you get to Yeshayahu and Yechezkel and some of the sort of Second Temple parts of the Bible, it does seem like we've gone a little farther than the initial framing of a ger that just is other but happens to have some rights. You start to feel like the boundaries of this construction of Israel are sort of expanding in all kinds of ways. But nonetheless, this is really a mode of interpretation that essentially rereads, right? The word ger is going to be reread in almost every place that we see it now to refer to the convert. Now, this has two very significant consequences. I don't want us to miss this. On the one hand, this move pushes the character we met as the biblical ger out. Okay, because the implication is all those sources that seem to demand things of and require responsibility towards the ger, that is to say, another ethnic person who is in our place, well, that person is now like not actually talked about in most places in the Torah. And we're going to see that takedown in a second in very specific ways. All right? On the one hand, reading ger to mean convert means that this liminal character seems much less liminal. They just seem like they're an outsider now, and the only people we can talk about is the convert, who has some kind of protection and responsibility. But the flip side of this I want us to note is, remember last week we said, the Bible though, certainly the First Temple pieces of the Bible, don't have a clear mode of converting at all. In other words, the closest you could get to being an Israelite and not be an Israelite in the Torah is to be the ger of the Bible. Now, in the rabbinic rereading, you can actually, as a ger, kind of go all the way in. You can actually convert You can be mitgayer, go through a process where you change your status. That is actually much more of a porous boundary than existed necessarily in the Torah, even as it does it at the cost of marginalizing this other category. We'll see the very concrete application of that in a second, but I also just want to flag for you sort of the terminology that we're now going to begin to see. The Torah has actually a somewhat rich set of terms that it uses to talk about the different people in the world. There's going to be B'nai Yisrael. There's going to be the Ger, who lives there. There's going to be the Nochri, who is the foreigner, who doesn't really live there, but is outside. And the Nochri itself is divided, actually, into all kinds of categories, like the Mitzri, the Edomi, the Ammoni, the Moavi. These are all different nations that actually have like different laws that apply to them, right? There are actually rules that apply to an Egyptian that don't apply to an Ammonite, that don't apply to an Edomite. There's a kind of sense of, yeah, there's this, there's outsiders, there's some people who are in the middle. What we're going to see in the transition to these rabbinic sources is we have much more B'nai Yisrael, Geirim, who are now converts, who are basically kind of a package with this group. And then over here, you basically have the Goy, the Gentile, with whom is going to be grouped another character, what's going to now get called the Ger Toshav. A Ger Toshav will be kind of a code for some remnant of that biblical ger we talked about in much more robust form last week, not being the subject of most of what the Torah talks about, but occasionally popping up. And part of our investigation as we go forward, really beyond this week, will be what robustness does this category have anymore? This category of someone who is not a convert, but it's hard to say, capture them just as they are a Gentile and there's nothing else I can say about them. There's something distinctive or liminal about them. But this is a major shift here, even just the way I've tried to give you like a graphic representation of it in terms of the terminology we're going to use. Okay. Adina, did you have one?
I was just asking you, the biblical categories of B'nai Yisrael, Ger, and Nochri, women are different, right?
Yes. So we mentioned this, I think, briefly last time.
Like, women can become part of B'nai Yisrael without being...
That's correct. Women are sort of like in a, they are gray, even grayer than the shades of gray here, in the sense that it seems like they can flip between categories in various ways, primarily by marriage.
Well, not if there's
some kinds of, even that is not 100% clear, but that's right. The Canaanites, well, I didn't even mention them. Obviously, there's the Sheba Amim, the seven indigenous nations, have their own rules, and there the status of the women seems to matter more than in other cases. So there's a lot there that plays out for sure once we get to the women who are fundamentally more marginal in the patriarchal structure. By the way, I will say, this is not our topic. That is another major thing that changes when you get to a rabbinic framework, where I put in the simplest terms, some of my students heard me say this yesterday morning, the biggest shift is, in the Bible, on some level, you can get the impression that women are people married to Israelites. In rabbinic literature, women are Jews. That doesn't mean they're exactly the same, but their status as Jews actually matters completely independently of the men to whom they're married. That's a major shift. Yeah?
The term goy, does that occur in Tanakh? And how does it differ from what you're saying? Because right here, it doesn't sound like it means nation. It sounds like it means something.
That's right. So we're going to come back to some comments on this in the end for those seriously interested. Yishai Rosen-Zvi, who's a professor at Tel Aviv University, has just written a number of very deep and intricate articles about this. One of them is called Goy, a genealogy, which really explores in deep ways. We may come back to comment on this. What it means to have a terminology like this. Two things happen that give us the word goy. One is the shift from it referring to a collective noun of a nation to an individual person. right? Mi goy gadol asher lo Elohim krovim elav is the way the Torah will say, what a great nation, and it talks about Israel. It's just a collective noun, and there's lots of goyim. A goy is an individual person who can be described as having that. That's one shift. But the other thing is the sort of binary element of this, of turning the entire world into Jews, and the totally preposterous term non-Jews, right? Like, we use that all the time in Jewish sources. It's a completely outrageous term in the sense, I'm not even getting to it. You might find it pejorative, but, you know, I was talking about this with my daughter this morning, who's a lefty. So would you ever walk around like talking about the rest of the world as non-lefties? Right? Like, you would never do that, right? That's crazy. Or another kind of example, it's like, I'm going to go out one night this week on a non-Sunday. Right? Like, you don't talk that way about something that's one of many. And therefore, because of this, as part of what Rosenzweig points out, in the Bible, there's not Israelites and everyone else. There's Israelites and like 70 other nations. Now, we have opinions about a lot of those other people, but there's not a sort of like one group and everyone else is sort of insignificant, at least in many parts of the Bible. Part of what Rosenzweig actually argues is that Dvarim has a little more of a like Nochri category that is sort of general, but it still does not have the flattening nature of this. Okay, let's move on to see now some of the actual work that happens here. So let's turn to page 3. I want you to see, I hope this won't make you too sad, the ways in which some of the sources you might have found the most sort of uplifting last week in terms of the expansiveness and generosity of including people in the larger Israelite polity get read very, very differently. So, for instance, the Torah in Vayikra says, on page 3, don't go and pick up every last little thing in your vineyard and things that are, you know, too small to really harvest. Leave them behind for the ani, the poor, and the ger. That seems to be the non-Israelite who doesn't have land and who needs to be taken care of. There's a mitzvah, an obligation to provide that person with charity. So too, in Dvarim, the second source here, when you finish off taking all the maaser, the tenth of your produce at the end of the third year, what do you do with that? You give it to the Levi, another landless character, the ger, and the atom and the almana, the widow, the orphan and the widow. Okay? Straightforward reading again is you have to help the non-Israelites along with the Israelites. What matters is vulnerability, not ethnic background. Look what the Sifra does. Le'ani, to the poor. Could that apply to the poor of others? All right, here already you don't have goy, but you have the notion of others, like everyone else. Okay? Could it be that I have an obligation to leave that charity for the poor of others? Talmud lomar, lager. Now, we see that le'ani is juxtaposed to lager. Okay, now ger here, right, it's like a second order midrash. For this to work, you have to assume that ger, by default, means someone who became a Jew and is no longer other. But the midrash catches itself here and says, wait a minute, but ila ger, yachol leger toshav? Couldn't it be that this verse is talking about what they now refer to as a ger toshav, meaning someone who is not Jewish, but is nonetheless in your sort of economic sphere of responsibility? Talmud lomar la levi, ma levi ben brit, af ger ben brit. All right, this is an amazing midrash and how it works. What does it do? It starts in Vayikra, where you have two terms next to each other, the ani and the ger. The ani is the poor person. I don't know if it's poor Jews or poor everyone. I look to ger. I say, well, ger seems like it's a Jew. It's a person who converted to Judaism. But then I'm like, well, I'm not sure. Maybe ger means someone who's not Jewish, who's a ger toshav. Then I jump to the verse in Deuteronomy and I see the Levi is juxtaposed to the ger. And if the Levi and the ger are together, it must be that the ger shares equality with the Levi. And if the ger and the Levi are to be in the same category, just as the Levi is a ben brit, a member of the covenant, a Jew, so too the ger we're talking about must be the ben brit, and then going back to Vayikra, if that's the kind of ger we're talking about, the ani, the poor person, must also be a ben brit, a member of the covenant of the Jewish people. Okay? You follow just the work of the Midrash, how it does that? It has transformed the verse from a scattered collection of people who the only thing they share in common is their vulnerability, to now a list that it assumes are different kinds of Jews. Some of them are Levim, who don't have land because of that. Some of them Gerim, they converted in, and some of them are poor. But they're all Jews. That is the limit of the responsibility of the charity. Yeah.
Isn't the Sifra being unusually obtuse in this case? They normally would be bringing in a third piece to suggest that the laws that apply to Olalot, which is the verse in the laws in Vayikra, applies to Maser Ani as well. Because one could clearly make, even at the level of the Tanaic Midrash, say, well, the laws that apply, the categories that apply to Olalot, are not necessarily the same as the laws applying to Maser Ani.
It certainly could do that. I think there is an assumption here, and we can argue how much are we really reading the text, how much do we already have a sort of worldview, and then we're trying to be accountable to the text, but we start with a presupposition. At the end of the day, the primary axis of interest here is basically who's in and out vis-a-vis charitable obligations. And their read, I don't think it's a terrible read, though I agree with you it's unnecessary, is that laws that are about giving things to poor people, even though Olelot might be one and Maaser Ani might be the other, are ultimately about caring for the poor. And therefore, I would assume the same scope of people is implied by both of them. Is it 100% necessary reading? No. A lot of this, I would say, is not necessary. The deeper part that's not necessary is, why do people juxtapose on the list, like both have to have the same ethnic extraction to be commanded by the Torah to care for them? But that's the assumption. By the way, ethnic extraction is wrong, right? Because the convert also does not have shared ethnic extraction with the Jew. But the convert is somehow transformed to be a part of the group. By the way, this is the thing. I want you to catch yourself each time with this. On the one hand, this has totally thrown the Ger Toshav out of the circle of charity, at least vis-a-vis this verse. But it has also brought in the convert no longer as sort of a ward, but as just a full equal of the community. Now, I'm not claiming you had to do one in order to do the other, but I want us to see sort of what's happening here, right? The only person, there was no convert receiving charity under the biblical scheme, because it doesn't seem like there was a convert, but we are now saying there's no one in that position. I'll mention this now just because it's important to mention for understanding, but I don't want to get caught up on it. We do also have to have running in the back of our mind, what does it mean to have fundamentally stateless rabbinic texts talking about these issues, right? It costs them nothing in reality to throw the Ger Toshav under the bus. They don't have any Gerim V'Toshavim. The closest they have to people who are resident in their communities but not part of them is someone who says, hey, I'd like to join the Jewish people, and they come in and they live with them, and those people are basically converts, okay? So I don't want us to downplay the significance of both the exegetical and conceptual move here, but I don't want us to like overplay it as if we're dealing with, you know, a Knesset that's passing legislation where there's actually a group here and a group here, and you are kicking this group out to favor that group. Right, because the Ger Toshav group in these rabbinic texts doesn't really exist in any meaningful way, whereas the Ger, the convert, does in some real way. Okay, let me show you a couple other things here. Purity, tum'ah. Right, one of the things we saw last time was, it seems like, okay, v'chol nefesh asher tochal nevelah u'treifa. Any person, right, and in case you're in doubt about what any person means, ba'ezrach u'bager. Whether native-born or ger, who eats nevela, treifa, things that will make them impure, has to bathe and launder their clothes, and then they'll be tamei until the evening and then become pure again. And if they don't do that, they bear the consequences. Okay? Look at the sifra here. V'chol nefesh. Any person. Yachol af hagoy? Could that also mean a Gentile? That if a Gentile eats a carcass, they become impure and all the rules apply to them? Talmud lomar, ger. No, it says a ger. So once we say by ezrachu v'ager, here too, our assumption is, well, ger must mean someone who converted to Judaism. Here too, the Midrash catches itself. E ger, yachol af ger toshav. Right, but maybe it does include at least a Gentile who is in this liminal state. Talmud lomar, ezrach. Ma ezrach ben brit, af ger ben brit. Here, the juxtaposition of ezrach uvager, a similar amazing rereading. The juxtaposition of ezrach and ger, as we read it in the Torah, was even though there's a clear and obvious hierarchy in terms of society between these two, I'm telling you to flatten that hierarchy or narrow the gap between these two characters. Here, by Zarach of Ager, the only way I could say them in one breath is if they're basically the same. And the only way it can be basically the same is if Ger means the kind of Ger who is a Jew. Just not by birth. But come on, the difference between the Zarach and the Ger is minimal, and that's why we can talk about it. The Goy, even the Ger Toshav, right? Here you see this very clearly, right? The people in this box, you can't compare. These people have a major gap between them. Like, the ger is different from the ezrach of Bnei Yisrael, but they're kind of basically the same. They have to observe mitzvot, all their kids are born Jewish, all that stuff. On this side, the ger toshav is different from the goy, but now, instead of living in the middle, is a kind of subcategory of the other, at least in this reading in the Sifra. All right, so you appreciate what's happening here in the reading of the Midrash. That's taking us to a very different place. Let me show you another powerful example of this. The most inclusive moment we saw last week was the idea, one of the most, we'll get to another one later, was the idea that the ger, as long as the ger circumcises himself, he doesn't even have to be an Israelite to participate in the Korban Pesach. That seemed to be the best reading of Shemot Yudbet. Okay? And that's the passage here in C. There was another statement earlier in that paragraph that said, Toshav v'sachir lo yochal bo. Alright, now Toshav v'sachir seemed to be a person you hired to live with you. Alright, I gave the example of the sachir is like the babysitter, the Toshav is like the au pair. Okay? Short term, long term, in-house help. Those people, it seems the Torah means, they can't eat of the Pesach because they don't really live there. Like, they're living in your house, but just because they're there to do a job for 7 years. The ger, who is actually established residence, that's why that person can join in and the other two can't. But look what the Mechilta does on the bottom of three. Toshav v'sachir lo yochal bo. What is the meaning of that verse? Toshav, ger toshav. Sachir, goy. The Toshav and the Sachir now are not Gentiles who are not enough in Israelite society to be a part of the Pesach, whereas the Ger is in enough to be a part as long as he's circumcised. Now the Toshav and the Sachir are just synonyms for this box, which is outsiders. There is the goy, that's the sachir, is someone who just is not in the picture at all. The toshav now is not someone who's like live in hell, but fundamentally from outside. They might even live there. They might be a permanent resident of your society. That person cannot be a part of the Korban Pesach. The only person who can be a part of the Korban Pesach is where the Midrash then takes the later part of this, where v'chiyagur itchem ger v'asa pesach ladoshem. When you're dealing now with a verse that says when the ger wants to do a Pesach, who are we talking about? The convert. Okay? So we have removed the possibility of this person who is sort of half in, half out, participating in this ritual moment. Instead, we've enabled someone to become a Jew, but if they have not made that transition, of course, they can't participate in the Korban Pesach. Okay, let me pause here and just sort of get an initial read from you, thoughts. Why? What do you think? What do you think's going on here? Right? Why? There's some degree of somewhat forced reading and rereading here. And by I want to be careful. I don't mean it's an impossible reading of the Torah, but it is not the way we would necessarily come to read those verses if we just came to them with fresh eyes as we tried to last week. So this is a reasonably heavy-handed reading of the verses. What's going on? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, I think it has to do with the sociology of the times. I mean, these Midrashim were written at a time when the Jews were no longer living in the land.
Well, most of the Midrashim are Jews who are living in the land, but let's say they're not sovereign in the land.
Okay.
They're not in charge.
Okay. And maybe they're experiencing, you know, extreme anti-Semitism, shall we call it, you know, which is an anachronism. And that they're kind of to protect themselves and to hold on to the to hold on to whatever remnant they have.
All right. So one possibility you can say is that the development of the binary in some way is in the service of better defining the boundaries of the group. We're stuck with some combination of a biblical record that allows for someone from the outside to be at least somewhat in, and perhaps even some kind of proactive vision where we want that to happen. But we don't want there to be all kinds of shades of gray along the way, because we feel that will lead to sort of threaten the stability or the identity of the group. And if the group is feeling somewhat powerless or insecure, tighter definition around who is in and out might be a benefit. All right, that's a sort of socio-political explanation of thinking about this. Okay, other thoughts, yeah.
I don't know, but could there have been a concern about women at this point didn't have their own, I can't tell if they have their own independent status as this is being written or if that's written in the process, but like, if there was a concern about who they are marrying, opening up a track for men to join the group in this more formal way seems like a good idea.
Great. So the motivation to allow people in, right? In other words, one question is, why is the Ger Toshav pushed out? The other thing you could say is maybe the primary motivation is to find a way for people to come all the way in. And, you know, both the way this might work conceptually and also the way biblical interpretation tends to work, at least in a rabbinic mode, is you can't have the same verse kind of talking about two things at the same time. And so to the extent you really want to ground in a clear way the notion of you can convert to Judaism, right? Which is not necessarily the most self-evident or plausible idea, right? Again, some of us who were learning in this room Wednesday morning talked about this in a different shiur. You can't convert to being a Kohen. There are some good jokes about that, okay? You can't do that. And some people might be annoyed about that, and some people for that reason may be like, I'm not interested in the kuna, the priesthood, etc. But it's something we just sort of take for granted. Our understanding of what it is to be a Kohen is it's something you inherit, you can't convert into it. It's perfectly reasonable to say, well, isn't that the way B'nai Israel works also? And it's pretty reasonable reading of the Bible if that's true. The closest you can get is a ger. If you want, though, to say, that's not how we think about it. And we're the heirs of Yeshayahu and thinking about Gentiles who come and attach themselves. Well, then I got to look somewhere. I got to anchor that somewhere. The ger is the obvious character who that needs to be. The cost is going to be that the ger toshav, who was otherwise in that space, is going to be marginalized. Great. Any other thought about this? Yeah.
Well, in elaboration of the earlier point, historical circumstances brought new categories of marginal groups before the middle class. Specifically, Samaritans, who were the leftovers, who they found living in the land after Shivat Zion, and also the phenomena of the Romans who, or Greeks and Romans, who were very attracted to the, particularly to the ceremonies at the temple, which became a tourist spot already by the time of before the destruction. Then, I mentioned it basically last time, there was a small group, the Netinim, which had come already from before the destruction of the first temple, who were reported to have returned to Israel after the exile. There's very little material about them, but I'm just suggesting that that new categories of identity that are marginal but possible could be generating the need to make a certain degree of clarity.
Great. So I think it's actually a great point, and I'll say just one thing about that, and then we'll move on to the next bit. It seems undeniably true that that's correct as a sort of description of reality at the time. And then the question I always want to ask myself is, I can imagine the exact same description that you just offered as being seen as an opportunity to expand, an opportunity to branch out. These are discussions that are going on right now, obviously, around all kinds of issues around the boundaries of the Jewish community.
One other category, which are the Edomites, who were forcibly either converted or brought into the Hasmonean realm, and many of them were converted. And then, of course, you have in the form of Herod, the national leader.
Right. So there's a lot of folks. There's a lot of folks in this in-between space. What I just want to also throw out as another possibility, which may go to sort of the heart of some of the actual mitzvot that are here, we should also be open to the possibility that there may be a rabbinic resistance to, maybe even allergy to, someone being half in, half out on Jewish practice and obligation. That is to say, we've had some demographic explanations, political explanations. There may also be a kind of theological objection of, I have no problem with crossing the ethnic boundary. That doesn't matter. You came from out here, but you want to come in here, great, no problem. But what I want clarity on is not necessarily kind of group identity in the political sense, but my sense of what it means to serve God or to fulfill obligations is to be an obligated person, to actually have somehow in my essence a sense in which I am part of the covenant. I actually even think the term here, ben brit, indicates something. What it means to be in the group is not just, well, I'm around the group and I take part in stuff, etc. Sure, that exists. The Ger Toshav may be a part of that. But what there may be is a desire to say, it's not just a sort of sliding scale of involvement. There is sort of a moment, even an embodied moment, where one switches from one status to another. That may be another element. I'll give you just the last word on this.
Yeah, it was. I was going to say that it feels like the rabbis are taking a lot of power by creating these categories, and not only social power, but power in sort of empowering the whole project of rabbinic Judaism by retroactively reading biblical texts to say, and like infuse these terms that become rabbinic terms, and to like differentiate what becomes Judaism from Israelite religion and Israelite culture.
Great, so that shift also, we're redefining a lot of terms here, and it's a sort of larger system redefinition in some ways as well. Great, okay. I want us to sort of recognize something that is an interesting corollary and consequence of this process, which is one of the things the Torah did pretty well was it brought the ger, which meant something slightly different, it brought the ger in very clearly whenever the ger belonged. It was like, don't eat blood, I mean you and the ger. If you come in contact with a corpse, you've got to do such and such ritual, you and the ger, right? Over and over. It throws the ger in, and you're kind of very clear where the ger stands. Like, our problem last week was not knowing kind of what the Torah says about the ger. It was maybe thinking, is there a coherent philosophy to this? But the Torah is very explicit. Once you replace, and let me say one other thing, and the fact that the Torah sometimes brought the ger in and sometimes didn't was also not puzzling, because you're dealing with a liminal figure. So it stands to reason that, yeah, the person might have to fast on Yom Kippur and not do melacha on Yom Kippur and maybe not do melacha on Shabbat. But it might also be that they're like, they don't have to wear tzitzit, or they're out of all kinds of other things that are not, you know, expected of someone at that remove. Problem is, once you replace ger from meaning what we now call the ger toshav to being what will often be called the ger tzedek, the convert, well, if the convert, though, is supposed to be the equal to the born Jew in all religious obligation, you then have a little bit of the problem where the ger is then absent from all kinds of places in the Torah. Right? The new improved ger, okay, who is now the convert who has become a Jew, you have a little bit of problem. Either I shouldn't have mentioned that person at all, because it should just be, yeah, there's different ways of becoming B'nai Israel. You can be born or you can convert, and that's like a separate thing, which you just hyperlink to everything in the Torah. Or it should have mentioned the ger everywhere. So one of the things you see that's really interesting in Rabbinic Midrash is then a need in all kinds of places to find the ger, the convert. Right? And this is very odd. When you first encounter these Midrashim, you're like, why are they doing that? I thought the convert's the same as the Jew. Why do I need a separate verse to play that out? But it's the residue of this process of renaming the ger in the Bible as the convert, and then the fact that that character appears only sporadically and erratically. So look on page 5. Vager uva'ezrach ha'aretz. This, in the Mechilta on the first page, this is the verse where the Torah says the ger is not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach. Okay? We explained that last week as, yeah, it could be. You live in Jewish zoned space, you can't eat chametz on Pesach. It doesn't matter that you're not an Israelite. But once ger comes to mean the convert, well, obviously, the convert can't eat chametz on Pesach. What else are we talking about? So the Mechilta says, Bager bezrach ha'aretz, because it is an action and physical practice taken by a Jew, it needs to be, the Torah needs to find a way to include the ger here. Okay? So too in all places that involve an action by Jews. This is almost a programmatic statement, which is, we're going to have to find everywhere in the Torah where a Jew is doing an action, and we assume the ger is included, a way of including the ger. This is the first place where ger appears in a mitzvah, so the Mechilta jumps in and tells you that's what it's doing here. But then there are other places where the ger does not appear so easily. So jump down, I'm sorry, I missed the translation on this, jump down two texts, Sifra Emor. All right, it's untranslated. The Hebrew starts with a tet in parentheses. You may recall from last week one mitzvah where it seems that the ger is not included in the Torah is to live in a sukkah. Right? It says, Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukkot. All the native born in Israel shall live in Sukkot. Now, when ger meant the ger toshav, we had some questions, interesting, what's that about? But it didn't bother us that you might, okay, the ger toshav doesn't live in a sukkah. Who cares, right? But once now ger means someone who converted to Judaism, how can the Torah say only the ezrach dwell in Sukkot? We don't want to say it's someone who converts to Judaism doesn't have to live in a sukkah. That doesn't make any sense. So watch what the Sifra does. Ezrach, ze ezrach. Right? Ezrach on its own refers to the native born. Ha-Ezrach with the hey. Okay? Now let's see, the base text here says it seems to be l'rabote tanashim, but that seems to be a mistake because the rabbinic tradition is that men are expected to live in a sukkah, but women are not. So the proper reading is probably ha-Ezrach l'hotzi et hanashim. That is to say, when I say the citizen, I mean the citizen par excellence, etc., meaning the paradigmatic citizen, which will be the man and not the woman. Separate shiur and discussion. Kol ha'ezrach l'rabot et haktanim. When I say all of the citizens, it means even kids have to be in the sukkah. also separate discussion. But now look at this. Be Yisrael lirabot gerim v'avadim meshuchrarim. When it says in Israel, the word in Israel means to add in converts and slaves owned by Jews who were freed. What's happened here? A verse that implicitly excluded the ger. We have now found a midrash basically to read the ger into the word of all words, be Yisrael. Kol ha'ezrach be Yisrael. The midrash basically assumes it otherwise could have said, kol ha'ezrach yeshev basukot. Right? The fact that it said kol ha'ezrach be Yisrael indicates there's some larger set of people that we're talking about here, and that includes the gerim. Right, this is a real inversion of the sort of syntactic meaning of the verse, even as I'm not sure what alternative the Sifra has. Once ger is going to mean the convert who comes in and takes on the full covenant, something like this has to happen. Now, the other meltdown that happens in this regard is with respect to Yechezkel. For those of us who were here last week, there was this really almost wacky passage in Yechezkel saying that the gerim get to inherit land based on the tribe in which they live. Literally, they like become a part of the people. We almost said that almost sounds like conversion in the sense of how could you say that a resident alien is going to, you know, have land with everyone else, even though that may be the plain sense of Yechezkel. Look what happens here in the Sifrei B'Midbar, another early Midrash, not on Vayikra, not on Shmot, but on B'Midbar. This is an amazing exchange. The Midrash here is playing out. Why did Moshe's father-in-law leave after they left Mount Sinai? They have this kind of poignant exchange where Moshe says to him, come with us. We're going. We're going to the place that God said He's going to give to you. Come along. And he says, no, I'm going home. And the question is, why? Why does he check out? So the Midrash imagines the following, that Yitro says, mirroring back to what Moshe said, what did Moshe say to him? We're going to the place about which God said, I will give it to you. And Yitro says, lachem, to you, ve'ein la gerim bo chelek. The gerim, here meaning converts, and Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law, is understood to be a convert in this tradition. You're inviting me, but you don't have a place for me. I'm not a member of a tribe. I'm not going to get any land. There's no point in my coming. So then the Midrash says, almost like, but didn't he know about Yechezkel? It's only going to be, you know, given a couple hundred years later. That doesn't matter. We live in four-dimensional space in Midrash. Ma ani mekayem v'haya hashevet asher gar hageri to sham titnu nachalato. What about the verse in Yechezkel which says that gerim do get inheritance? And now, this is always amazing when Midrashim do this. Ela, im eino inyan leYerusha, teneu inyan leChapara. If it can't be about what it seems to be about, it's about inheritance. But if it can't be about inheritance, because there's no possible way a convert could actually inherit tribal land, is the presumption of this text, it must be about atonement. What does that mean? There's some kind of public atonement, public sacrifices, maybe in a time when there's not a mikdash, that the ger attains atonement through the public atonement in the places where he lives. Or on the last line here, davar acher, or two lines from the wide lines from the bottom, variantly, if it cannot speak of inheritance, understand it as speaking of burial. That gerim are allowed to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that's the Yerusha. This text totally deconstructs the idea that you could actually have gerim of any form, including converts, inheriting in a tribal division. And so it basically says the verse is not talking about what it's talking about. Right? That just sort of shows you the shift we've gone through, I think, not just in terms of definition, but in terms of assuming that, and on some level there's even an assumption in this text, which is you can sort of play two games, but you can't play them at the same time. You can play the tribal, full descent, land-based game, where everyone belongs to Yehuda and Yisachar and this and that and the other thing, and people are dominant on the land, and maybe even then you could imagine there being a Ger Toshav. Or you can have a system where people are basically in because they joined the mission in some way, and then it doesn't make sense to talk about people lateraling into some tribal identity. What you have to work with instead is people have crossed from this to this, and this has sort of changed. This is no longer about tribe and lineage and political sovereignty and land. It's about being part of a group that's defined a different way. All right? Okay. Thought, question, comment on that piece before we go to see now what is left of the Ger Toshav. Because there actually is, in rabbinic literature, some remnants of this category, and it's interesting to see how that plays out. Yeah?
Do we know where they're getting this material?
Not sure. I think it's the best they can do with what does it mean to have a chelek, to have a portion. Burial is, I think, very intuitive in that sense. You're not going to inherit land, but you'll get access to the land for something else. The kapara is a little more mysterious, what the atonement is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When was the period when they couldn't own their own land anymore? I mean, you had buildings in there. What did that mean, owning land?
Yeah, well, they own land then. They definitely own land. They pay some crippling taxes at various points to the Romans. But the Jews definitely own land. You know, even in early, we have a sort of whole narrative about Jews in Europe. They weren't allowed to own land. That's true at a certain point. And it's certainly true once Jews get displaced from one place to another and they show up, it's not always easy for them to own land. But at early points of medieval history and throughout European history, there are always Jews who owned land. So I think we always have to be careful about putting too much onto a reading of, well, they don't have that system at all, but what they don't have at all is any kind of tribal system. That's the sense in which even the passage in Yechezkel, it's not clear exactly what he's talking about, writing in the Second Temple sort of return period. Does he really imagine the tribes are all going to come back? Or is that the way of talking about a messianic future, or is it a way of talking about you're going to redistribute the land, you'll have your other definitions of your tribe? That's much less clear. But they are going back and owning land. Yeah?
So are there still these votes that a Ger Toshav is still implicated in by this freedom? And if so, and those rights? And if so, how are rabbis differentiating when Ger refers to you?
Good, I'm so glad you asked. Let's continue on the bottom of page 5 and see a couple examples of this, okay? One of the issues that we saw, one of the places where Ger came up, you remember, was Shabbat. Kiddush on Shabbat morning, V'gercha asher bisharecha, and other verses, V'yinafesh ben amatcha v'hager. The Ger is included in the mitzvah of Shabbat, actually, right, in two totally different contexts. It's hard to avoid the presence of the Ger there. And even though you could have imagined it being totally avoided and sidelined, oh, that's the Ger Tzedek, here, interestingly enough, rabbinic sources retain it. They are somewhat divided as to how to retain it and how to read it in. Actually, turn to page 6. The two passages in the Megillah that we started with argue as to whether it's the verse in the Ten Commandments that refers to the convert and the verse in Mishpatim that refers to the Ger Toshav or vice versa. But there is an assumption that the Torah in at least one place says something or might say something about the Ger Toshav. You'll see this in the clearest sense in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Yevamot. All right, someone want to volunteer to read this? Please. Nice and loud. And follow in the other language.
Rabbi Yehuda says, a Ger Toshav on Shabbat is like a Jew on Yom Tov. Just as a Jew bakes and cooks, but is forbidden in all other kinds of melacha, so too Ager Tushav on Shabbat. Rabbi Yossi says, Ager Tushav on Shabbat is like a Jew on Chol HaMoed. Just as a Jew on Chol HaMoed can gather sticks from the field, but is forbidden to do other work in the field, so too Ager Tushav on Shabbat. Rabbi Shimon says, Ager Tushav on Shabbat is like a Jew on the regular days of the year. Just as a year...
Sorry, it should be Jew, yeah.
Just as a Jew plows, sows, and reaps the rest of the year, so too a Ager Tushav on Shabbat.
All right, this is a great debate, I think, for two reasons. One, because you can hear the exegetical argument behind it. Okay, in other words, Rabbi Shimon, the last view, actually clearly did read the Torah as just wiping out Ger Toshav with respect to Shabbat at all. He had some reading of Gercha, Asher Bisharecha, that's a Ger Tzedek. V'inafesh ben amatcha ve'ager, that's a Ger Tzedek. Torah never talks about Ger Toshav on Shabbat, therefore a Ger Toshav on Shabbat does whatever he likes. But the other two views assume that the Ger Toshav is forbidden from doing something, but they are not able to accept the notion that the Ger Toshav could actually be fully obligated in Shabbat. So they look for other models that we could describe as being lo ta'aseh kol melacha, don't do melacha, don't do work, that are not full but still recognizable from the perspective of halacha. And those are basically Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed, where you're half in and you're half out, as appropriate to a person who's half in, half out. That's the sort of reading version here. Now, I think it's also fascinating to think about this in terms of kind of public policy, zoning public space, and what it looks like to have a standard of sort of public Shabbat that is not completely uniform, but that is nonetheless sort of universal in some way. So this text to me was actually very compelling, spending a lot of time the past 2 years in Tel Aviv, thinking about being in a city where it's not no one's doing melacha, but it's kind of like Chol HaMoed. It's actually kind of like a city where, like, people don't go to the office, they are not going out to, like, I mean, no one's really farming in Tel Aviv, but, right, you're not doing, there's all sorts of things that, they're not happening, and totally, people are behaving the way I would behave on Chol HaMoed. And that is part of what actually gives a sense of, I always felt, people spend too much time in Yerushalayim, are not able always to appreciate this, but it felt like Shabbat. Right? Now, did it feel like everyone was observing all the restrictions I was observing? No. But there was something that sort of publicly happened here. This is an aspect where the Ger Toshav is retained, at least for some of the Tanayim here, and notably, right, in the sense here of responsibility. Right? We expect something of the Ger Toshav. We'll get in a minute to the economic protection piece. We expect something. That, I think, is actually a non-trivial remnant of the biblical view. Fortunately or unfortunately, Rabbi Shimon's view here, which pushes the Ger Toshav all the way over to the Goy with respect to Shabbat also, is the one that in the dominant halachic discourse wins out. Okay? The halacha is like Rabbi Shimon. But the fact that you have central Tanaim here, who their understanding is, yeah, you live in a Jewish majority space, Shabbat's obligatory on you in some way, that's a really interesting feature. Yeah,
how do you know if these statements are about prohibition or agency? How do you know these are things that you're, I mean, this is like a Taliban effect. Are you supposed to go out and prevent the Ger Toshav from doing these things?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you look at Zachor Yom HaShabbat, the other show, at the end of it says,
right.
Is these things that you can't ask them to be your agent to do things that are prohibited to you? So how do you know which one it is?
Great question. I'm not sure you know from the words here alone. From other parallel sources, some of which we will encounter in future weeks, I have a suspicion that it is perceived as an obligation that theoretically could be enforced. That is to say, it's not just an invitation, you should be doing this, but the Ger Toshav could be held accountable. But I want to temper that with the fact that it's also not being, there's no enforceability mechanism or capability in these texts in terms of the world they live in, which is to me one of the most sort of enticing and potentially scary elements of this topic when you think about actually translating it to a context where someone has power. You go to the Taliban, there's many other things that are short of getting to there, but on the path of that, like coercive political power allied with religion, which the Gertoshav simultaneously, I think here, and we're going to see in a second on the economic protection front, there's something that may be very uplifting or inviting about saying, you know, there are actually models here that we're saying something very important about being responsible to all the people who live in your midst. Now that there's actually power, the ability to do something about it, we should enforce that. Can you do that completely independent of the flip side of this coin of the responsibilities and expectations? The other things I would say, particularly when we think about this, not necessarily just in a Jewish political and religious context, but as a model for thinking about a society and the non-citizens who live in it. So translate it outside of Shabbat for a minute to some proxy for kind of basic value and atmosphere conditions that a society is trying to create. What are the responsibilities of the Ger Toshav to respond to that? And that too, I think, is we feel very mixed about that, particularly as Americans, in terms of personal liberties and everyone's right to do that. We tend to, as Americans, look unfavorably or suspiciously at efforts like those in France to zone the public space around dress, et cetera, et cetera. That said, I don't think the impulse to feel that the society is trying to create some kind of norm in its public space is necessarily totally foreign or a bad idea. The question is, what do we apply it to, and how do we not go off the rails in the process? But again, this is a total sort of a laboratory of theoretical models that I think part of what we're exploring is, are they useful? How do they move us forward or not? And that's one of the key questions. Yeah, one more comment on this. I want to make sure we see at least a few other things before we end.
Sure, and you might tell me if we're about to get to the answer to my question anyway. So if the, just given what you said to the question, if this protection of the society, or rather, if ensuring that the Ger Toshav avoids certain types of labors, is about preserving the integrity of a Jewish society and making it feel like the Jews are have their power consolidated in some respect, versus protecting the individual, which I think is more like how, for example, like Chabad would view you need to do a mitzvah, although that's also about bringing about, but there are times in which individuals are supposed to reach out to other Jews and encourage them to do mitzvot. This seems more about the society, and if that's the case, then does any of this apply in outside Israel? If we're not in power, does any of, we ever have to do this?
Right. So we're going to, in week 5, get a little more into the text that ask questions about, like, Ger Toshav Bazman Hazeh. Or where, you know, can you apply this today or in what context? So I'm mostly going to defer that. That's going to be one of the ultimately important questions in terms of thinking about application. Right now I want to play out, let's assume it can be applied more broadly, which we might abandon later, and sort of just play out what does that mean, okay? Whether as a direct application of the halakha, or as a sort of model offered by the halakha, that might be a useful way for Jews to think about these questions, even in contexts that transcend it. All right, so let's hold that question and we'll come back to it. Economic protection, okay? Here's another place where the Ger Toshav lives on. There's this verse in Vayikra. Now, I'm on page 6, I'm sorry. Jumped at the end of the Yerushalmi. So page 6, letter B, economic protection. When your brother falls low and his hand slips with you, v'chazakta bo ger v'toshav v'chayimach. Now, I'll just tell you, for the Pshat fans among you, Jacob Milgram argues that the plain sense of this verse is as follows. When your brother, who is an Israelite, falls low, and his hand slips with you, ve'echezakta bo, and you seize him, meaning, basically, he owes you money, okay? And he can't pay you, and you seize him, ger v'toshav, like you would a ger toshav. Okay? Just like, remember, Shlomo seizes the gerim v'toshavim as the forced labor force for his building projects, one of the things you would do is potentially seize someone when they owe you money. A ger toshav is the kind of person you would seize. We saw this last week. Also, you would buy them as a slave. Ultimately, they could slip into slavery in that way. Milgram says the point of this verse is to say, when your brother slips low, ve'hechazakta bo ger toshav, ger v'toshav, and you grab him like you would a ger v'toshav, v'chayimach, make sure he can live with you. And then the next verse is, lo tikach me'ito neshech v'tarbit, don't take interest from him to make sure that he can in fact end up paying back the loan and be free. Okay? So, according to Milgram, actually, this is one of the verses in the Torah that assumes a difference between the ger toshav and the Israelite. You've got to watch out for the Israelite in terms of not charging interest, giving him a way out of servitude. But the ger toshav, that's no problem. You seize that person, you own them as a slave. As we saw, the Bible assumes the ger toshav, if he got the upper hand, would totally own you as a slave. All right? It's just you don't have a patent. Mutual non-aggression pact with him. However, the rabbinic sources read this differently. In some ways, a little better with the actual syntax. When your brother slips, hold him up, not seize him. Okay, like think about when people, when we do a Misha Berach, a prayer for those who are sick. Right? And we talk about lahachazikam ulahachayotam. That's an intertext with this verse. To strengthen them and to give them life. Ve'chazakta v'chai. Okay? So they read it as support. If you look at the Sifrayer, okay? When your brother falls, don't let him go down. How do we know? Even if you supported him several times, support him again. Ve'chazakta bo. Okay? And then, when the verse says, ger v'toshav, what it means to say is, and that's true of the ger and the toshav also. You should also hold them up the same way you're expected to hold up your brother. And how is that glossed? Ger, ze ger tzedek, so that's the convert. But toshav, ze ger ochel nevelot. This is the ger who eats carcasses. And what is that? That's just a midrash pointing us back to Dvarim Yud Dalet, that verse that says the ger is allowed to eat a carcass. Okay, going back to the beginning, this is almost like the rabbis doing what I said we can't conclude the Greek translation of the Torah is doing. This toshav, they want to say, is a paroikos, not a proselutos. Okay? And this paroikos, this ger, who is a person who's allowed to eat treif food, you have a biblical obligation to support that person. Right? Now this leads to the rabbinic phrase, ger toshav anu mitzuvim lahachayoto. A ger toshav, we are obligated to sustain him in life. And that comes out of this reading of this verse. That is one of these verses that you can imagine, and we'll hopefully see some of this play out in future weeks, you can imagine being read very narrowly or very broadly, right? To sustain him in life could be read, all other Gentiles, it'd basically be better if you killed them. This is not an unheard reading in rabbinic literature. But the ger toshav, you're not allowed to do that. Okay? You got to treat him fairly, some due process, etc. That's the narrow reading, right? The broad reading is there's some kind of ongoing obligation that spills over into all spheres of economic activity. You cannot take advantage of this person. Not only that, you have to somehow actually invest in them. You are required to treat them, how much you invest in them per student, how much you give them access to healthcare, all the basic things that a society does to enable people to live, this text could be read as sort of the basis, the kernel of an idea. That applies to the Toshav, the Ger Toshav as well. Yeah.
In the Sifra, it talks about Ger carcasses, and you said it was a reference to Dvarim Yadalad, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much of this is also responding, do you think, to the Mishnah of Kulin, where it talks about if you make a mistake during Shkita, you can sell it to someone who is not Jewish in the area? Like, is there also other legal works in addition to the Midrashic works that talk about?
Yeah, so those sources are mainly just talking about what the Bible would have and the Mishnah would also usually call a Nokri, or a goy, where that person is outside of the framework. That's the O Machor Lenochri in Dvarim, where you're of course allowed to sell it. The only thing that's interesting about this figure who is the Ger is he is called a Ger, right? And this is a place where the Torah cannot avoid, the Chazal, the rabbinic sources cannot avoid, because of that verse, that there is someone who is out there who is called a Ger, who doesn't observe all the laws. Okay? Most of the sources where it says, Ager agar betochachem, we saw at the beginning, they're going to find a way, and I just brought you a representative sample, they'll find a way to say, no, that's the convert, that's the convert, that's the convert. But there will be some places where they will either, you can say, get stuck, or want to emphasize, well, there is still this person who is different from the goy, different enough that there is an obligation to sort of sustain them. They are not just completely outside, and you have a different relationship with them. Again, the question of how extensive that is, that's a big question. The next two passages here are an interesting example where actually the rabbinic record inserts the Ger Toshav, where he is not in any way implied in the Torah. Okay, I'm not really sure what to make of that. The passage in the Torah about the fugitive slave, which talks about when the slave runs away and comes to you, you guys can't send him back to the master. You got to give him a nice place to live wherever he wants. The rabbinic midrash out of nowhere says, yeah, that's true of the Ger Toshav too. You got to give him a good place to live. You can't put him in a bad neighborhood. You can't put him off on the border. Not clear what motivates the midrash to do that. They're not bound by the syntax of the verse or its vocabulary. They put the Ger Toshav in. Right? So those, on some level, it's a thin record, but with some sort of key principles that you can imagine being read very, very expansively. And again, I think I want to leave you with that notion of the v'chai imach, right? L'hachayoto, that's going to be the terminology that you can imagine expanding on if you want to look for what does it mean to say people who are resident in my midst in some way, I am responsible to them. Okay, I want us just to see, we're going to skip Roman numeral 5, okay? Roman numeral 5, you should look at. There's some pretty tough and intense texts there, which emphasize using the word re'ehu, as it appears many times in the Torah, your neighbor, repeatedly saying re'ehu does not include the Ger Toshav. This is a group of acherim over here, others, verses that say, if you do such and such to your rea, to your colleague, to your neighbor, don't apply to people who are not in that category, like a Ger Toshav. That sounds innocent and minor enough until you realize that among those things is like capital punishment for murder. Okay, meaning the way the Torah talks about being liable for killing someone is yake et re'ehu, and that actually leads to a whole jurisprudential line saying, well, the Ger Toshav, not clear you are actually guilty or can be tried for murder, for the murder of a Ger Toshav, even though if a Ger Toshav kills a Jew, certainly you try then. Now, there's internal rabbinic discussions of, is that just a jurisdictional point, and maybe God's going to come and get you? That's a sort of larger values piece we don't have time to unpack here. But I want you to be aware that another way that the Ger Toshav gets pushed out is by drilling down on words like re'ehu and wondering if the Ger Toshav is in or out. I want to just end here with the last thing in Roman numeral 6, the last source on page 9. which will launch us into. And if you look at that section 5, you'll see all the ways, all the ramifications potentially of taking a Ger Toshav out of Re'ehu, and that's going to compete with Lahachayoto, V'chayimach, which is pushing in the direction of sustaining and supporting the Ger Toshav. One of the things we did not get to, and we're just going to leave with sort of reading this and we're going to pick up with it next time, is, well, who counts as a Ger Toshav in the rabbinic scheme? Right? Because one thing is, what is the Torah talking about? It's talking about a Ger Tzedek, it's talking about a Ger Toshav, so if it's a convert, fine. We kind of more or less know what that is. Anyway, that's not the topic of this class. The Ger Toshav, the Ger in the Bible, was simple enough. You're another nation, but you're living in the land. What is Ger Toshav now in the rabbinic conception? And there is not consensus, surprisingly enough. And that is played out in this text on 9. I want you to see how this is both a really interesting debate, but itself an effort to try to read the Torah and understand what's happening. Ezeu ger toshav, kol shekibel alav bifnei shlosha chaverim shelo la'avod avodat kochavim, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says a ger toshav is someone who in some public way, acceptance in front of a panel of three, and I think that's really a proxy for something where, like, you know, they went through a process in some way that's obvious, not to worship idols. How does Rabbi Meir get to that? Nothing in the Torah that ever describes that. But if you look at the ways in which the Torah talks about wipe out all the idolatry in the land and wipe out all the people who are worshiping it, to the extent it tells you, you have to let the ger live there, it seems a basic requirement. Baseline is the ger is not an idolater. Because otherwise, basically, he never should have survived the onslaught against all the people who lived there. All right. So but Rabbi Meir has the most simple baseline requirement. He can't be doing something that is completely anathema to the religion of Israel, namely idolatry. That's view one. Just one sec. Chachamim omrim view two. Kol shekibel alav sheva mitzvot shekiblu aleihem b'nei Noach. He has to accept the 7 Noachide laws, a higher level. There has to be like due process of justice. There has to be some notion of kinship laws that are observed. There's got to be, you know, treating animals with a certain level of kindness. There's got to be, what else do we have on that list? Well, we can generate the rest of them. But a basic civilizational platform that's beyond just saying, well, I don't worship idols, but I might otherwise be kind of boundless, which would be fine for Rabbi Meir. According to the Chachamim, it's this added level, but no commitment whatsoever to the norms of the Torah. Fascinating position here. Acherim omrim, certain irony in Acherim, after all the ways we've seen Acherim be used, others say, Eilu v'bav lichlal ger toshav. Those don't count. They don't get to be in the category of ger toshav. Those people, Rabbi Meir and Chachamim are talking about, they're all goyim. They're just outsiders. What's a ger toshav? Ze ger ochel nevelot shekibel alav lekayem kol mitzvot amurot haTorah chutz meisur nevelot. Okay? This is like, first of all, a lot of people like dream of this as a possibility, right? You convert to Judaism, you'll follow everything, but you get to eat tree. Okay? That is the category here. Now, this is... fact-wise, seems to be an absurd category. Like, how could that exist? But what's happening here? Why did we pick Nevelot? Because truth be told, that's the only verse in the Torah where we are forced to accept a ger violating a law of the Torah. And this view is actually really fascinating because this final view essentially doesn't believe that there is or should be something like a ger toshav. Right, the only kinds of people there are, basically are, goyim, total outsiders, born Jews, people who completely converted to Judaism and accept the authority of all the laws, and people like that with an asterisk of Dvarim Yud-Dalet Kaf-Aleph, but which I am forced because of the verse to accept as an exception, but what it shows you is philosophically what I really think is the world operates on a very clear binary of people who are Jews or have become Jews and are in, and people who are out, which only makes more stark that the first two views are not charting that course. They are actually really trying to maintain, at least for some set of laws, people who are not observing the mitzvot, other than maybe the most basic one or the most basic seven ones. And out of that, we construct something in terms of our expectations and our responsibilities to them. John, I'm going to give you the last word here in a moment.
Is it better to be respected to the son of Congress himself?
Yeah, there's a lot of things around rabbinic biographies, how much we know, they're 100% true, but how does that inform you here?
I'm assuming that would give it any more incentive.
Yeah, let's remember, though, he's not talking about a convert here. He's talking about this figure of the Ger Toshav, who is some kind of remnant of a biblical figure who is much more robust, but after tonight's work has been somewhat cut down to size. There's more to say about this. I want you to take the questions we asked last time into next time and the time beyond, which is, so how does this affect our sense of why and when people have rights, opportunities, responsibilities, burdens? Because we've now created a whole new character we have to think about in terms of where they're placed on the grid of Jewish community and religious life. See you next week. Yes.